I would hope that our southernness and others' northernness and one's Vietnameseness and one's Americanness and one's Italianness and one's, you know, Jewishness and one's one's Arabness, all of these things, we can maintain the sensual variety of that and learn to take a delight in that difference and see instantly through or work out complexly through to that common human ground beneath. And that's where we ultimately pitch our sense of self, in our shared humanity, delighting in our surface differences.
Writer Robert Olin Butler. He'll be back in just a moment with more about his Pulitzer Prize-winning collection of stories, A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. This program is the concluding segment of New Southerners, a 13-part series highlighting the work of contemporary Southern writers. New Southerners is made possible by a major grant from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Robert Olin Butler is something of an unlikely Southerner. Thinking about growing up in the border state of Missouri, he says that people south of St. Louis called him a Yankee, while to people north of there, he was a Southerner. It's that same meeting of two worlds that Robert Olin Butler brought to the writing of A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, a collection of stories and novellas which won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1993. The people we meet and the voices we hear in A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain illustrate a collision and confluence of cultures, where hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese are making a new life in the American South in the wake of the Vietnam War. Robert Olin Butler will read an excerpt from the title story of A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain in just a few minutes. Right now, he begins with a reading from another story in that collection, one told in the voice of a Vietnamese woman living in the American South. It's called Fairy Tale.
I like the way fairy tales start in America. When I learn English for real, I buy books for children and I read Once Upon a Time. I recognize this word, upon, from some GI who buys me Saigon teas and spends some time with me, and he is a cowboy from the great state of Texas. He tells me he gets up on the back of a bull and he rides it. I tell him he is joking with Miss Noy, that's my Vietnam name, but he says no, he really gets up on a bull. I make him explain that up on, so I know I am hearing right. I want to know for true, so I can tell this story to all my friends so that they understand, no lie, what this man who stays with me can do. After that, a few years later, I come to America, and I read some fairy tales to help me learn more English. And I see this word, and I ask a man in the place I work on Bourbon Street in New Orleans if this is the same, up on and upon. He is a nice man who comes late in the evening to clean up after the men who see the show. He says this is a good question, and he thinks about it, and he says that, yes, they are the same. I think this is very nice, how you get up on the back of time and ride, and you don't know where it will go or how it will try to throw you off.
Robert Olin Butler, at first blush, the disparity between the American South and the topics that you write about in A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, that is to say Vietnamese themes, they seem miles apart, and yet they aren't really, are they? We're talking about North and South, the clash of cultures. Fill this in for me.
That's true. The the Vietnamese found their way into my part of the country, into southern Louisiana, initially pretty much by accident, just as they did elsewhere. That is, they came to the places where organizations sponsored them. But southern Louisiana, and particularly this community on the eastern end of Orleans Parish, out past New Orleans, on the way to Mississippi, or to Alabama too. That community called Versailles has become a particularly homogeneous one. You go out Chef Mentor Highway and past an old moribund NASA facility, and you turn off the highway, and there's a long run of Vietnamese shops on both sides of the street. And then you go over a little bridge over the bayou there and stop, and you look down, and all the ranch houses that used to hold NASA families now have Vietnamese families, and all the backyards are cultivated. And then there's a communal path behind these yards, and the verge of land down to the bayou is terraced and cultivated. And you see the old women there in their conical straw hats and black pantaloons working the fields there, the earth. Around the corner is a Catholic church where all the masses are in Vietnamese. It's a remarkably homogeneous community, and there's a certain appropriateness of climate. New Orleans is a sort of subtropical place. There's an appropriateness of cultural heritage in that the French influence in Vietnam corresponds to the long-standing French influence there in southern Louisiana. So there's around them there are rice growing in southern Louisiana. In fact, my very first trip into Louisiana was by plane, and I looked down and that tentative truce between the land and the water, and that sort of subtropical haze, yeah, and the rice paddies. It was very, very reminiscent of the Mekong Delta.
Now, Bob Butler, I know that you writers love to resist labels, but let me invite from you some reflections nonetheless. Do you think of yourself as a Southern writer looking at Vietnamese culture? Do you think of yourself as an American writer who happens to place Vietnamese themes in the American South? Are those labels important to you at all?
It's interesting. I'm into my second generation of label. I was a Vietnam novelist for some long time, and now I've become a Southern novelist, a Southern writer. My basic attitude about that is that because I am an artist, and because artists write from the deep impulse that comes from observing the chaos of moment-to-moment life on the planet Earth, and yet having some conviction that there is an order behind that chaos. That's why I write. That's why artists write. And they have to convey a vision of that order by telling stories. Since that is so, to call me a Vietnam writer or a Southern writer, to my mind, is like calling Monet a lily pad painter. And
so for the publicity people, this has some makes some
so.
Sense and creates
so. For
some
the
mileage
book reviewers, but yeah, but Vietnam for me, the South for me, any kind of identifiable label that could be put on my work in those ways is wildly inappropriate, I think. Those things are simply locations, metaphors, instigators of action, and so forth. They are my lily pads, and what I'm looking at that deeper universal pattern of light and shadow and form beneath them. That is the great leap that all artists take. That is the purpose of art. Artists are in the business of reassuring the world against our deepest individual fear, which is that in spite of appearances, we are all absolutely isolated and alone on the planet Earth. And
nobody wants to feel that.
No, it is that leap of faith, that sense that the artist can, through the senses, mm-hmm. get down to the deepest universal common ground, wherein we are neither northern nor southern, nor female nor male, Vietnamese nor American, Palestinian nor Israeli or whatever. We are profoundly and unifiedly human.
Bob Butler, we're talking about A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, your wonderful collection of stories, and this long novella that you also include in that book. Among the buzzwords of the scholars here at the Humanities Center are race, gender, ethnicity. Did you come to the writing of this book with words, concerns like that in your mind, as you looked at both Southern culture and Vietnamese culture?
No, I did not. It is antithetical to the artist's deepest impulses to come to the work, to her work, with any of those notions in mind as notions. You come to your work through your senses and through a deep connection to the human spirit.
And yet a lot of this stuff is very political. Now, politics is an abstract. Politics is, as you have pointed out, it runs counter to the artistic impulse to be very specific and very concrete. And yet you pull it off, I think.
Yes. In fact, it's interesting. I'm always amused by the fact that that critics, in fact, there was a major critical work on Vietnam writers that came out of the University of Georgia Press by a man named Philip Beidler called Rewriting America, who considers me the most political of my generation of so-called Vietnam writers.
And yet you disavow that.
I disavow that. On one hand. On the other hand, I absolutely understand what he means. Because politics, see, contrary to what most of us would like to believe, our deepest political convictions are not held rationally.
Emotionally.
They are deeply emotional.
Right.
And we put a kind of rational veneer on them to justify them. If that's so, the writer who goes into his work with a political agenda and a preconceived political idea that he's trying to get across.
What do you get?
Ultimately, is going to speak mind to mind.
You get clunky fiction.
You're going to get, but the point is, even if it's done artfully, smoothly, you're ultimately going to engage the reader's mind, not his deepest emotional self.
And which you want to do.
Which is entirely sensual.
Uh-huh. So,
and I, as an artist, engage the reader at that deepest sensual emotional level. And since I think it was Jonathan Swift who said you can't reason a person out of a position that he didn't reason himself into in the first place, those who speak mind to mind because they know their political idea ahead of time are ultimately going to persuade only those who are already believing in what's being said. I think my work can get through to the place where the deepest irrational political beliefs are held, and my work then is the most covertly and effectively political because it has an opportunity to shape the emotions which ultimately shape the most ardent political beliefs.
Well, to make this leap back to your affiliation, your affinity, your roots as a Southern writer, it's a fair statement to say that Southern literature represents that most deepest and emotional, Gothic is one word that we might use, of characteristics in our American experience.
If Southern literature is anything identifiable, and I'm not sure it is, it is certainly rooted in the senses, and it's rooted in the sensuality of voice as well. That we are enchanted with voices, and I certainly am. And it's those voices speaking, and evoking the sensual life that is at the heart not only of good Southern fiction but of all artistic fiction. Ho Chi Minh came to me again last night, his hands covered with confectioner's sugar. This was something of a surprise to me, the first time I saw him beside my bed, in the dim light from the open shade. My oldest daughter leaves my shades open, I think so that I will not forget that the sun has risen again in the morning. I am a very old man. She seems to expect that one morning I will simply forget to keep living. This is very foolish. I will one night rise up from my bed and slip into her room and open the shade there. Let her see the sun in the morning. She is 64 years old, and she should worry for herself. I could never die from forgetting. But the light from the street was enough to let me recognize Ho when I woke, and he said to me, "Dao, my old friend, I have heard it is time to visit you." Already on that first night, there was a sweet smell about him, very strong in the dark, even before I could see his hands. I said nothing, but I stretched to the nightstand beside me, and I turned on the light to see if he would go away. And he did not. He stood there beside the bed. I could even see him reflected in the window, and I knew it was real because he did not appear as he was when I'd known him, but as he was when he'd died. This was Uncle Ho before me, the thin old man with the dewlap beard, wearing the dark clothes of a peasant and the rubber sandals, just like in the news pictures I studied with such a strange feeling for all those years. Strange because when I knew him, he was not yet Ho Chi Minh. It was 1917, and he was Nguyen Ai Quoc, and we were both young men with clean-shaven faces, the best of friends. And we worked at the Carlton Hotel in London, where I was a dishwasher and he was a pastry cook under the great Escoffier. We were the best of friends, and we saw snow for the first time together. This was before we began to work at the hotel. We shoveled snow, and Ho would stop for a moment and blow his breath out before him, and it would make him smile to see what was inside him, as if it was the casting of bones to tell the future. On that first night when he came to me in my house in New Orleans, I finally saw what it was that smelled so sweet, and I said to him, "Your hands are covered with sugar."
Robert Olin Butler, we've just heard you read from A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain. That is the title story in your Pulitzer Prize-winning collection here. Here we have a mystical experience. We have a ghost story, so to speak. We have. Is there anything particularly Southern going on here? I mean, that is, after all, the premise of our conversation.
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on how much you wish to embrace the cliches of Southern fiction. And if you do, then obviously those are elements that are there.
I mean, apart from the fact that the narrator of this story happens to be in Louisiana, right, speaking to us from
right,
the page.
Yes. I think the heart of that story certainly has to do with an issue that is terribly important in the Southern cosmos, and that is the sense of the split, the polarity of the human spirit. The ghost of Ho Chi Minh comes to this old man. Now, Ho has taken a strictly political path in his life, a hard-edged political path, the northern path, if you will.
Uh-huh.
Dao, our narrator, has taken the more humanistic path, the path through religion,
we
the
have
sense
head,
of harmony.
Head and heart at work.
Head
here.
And heart, in a sense. The yin and yang, which is very important in Vietnamese philosophy. And the story's vision is that each of these men has taken an aspect of the human spirit, perhaps even inevitably, but is ultimately then incomplete because of it. Incomplete. And the vision that comes at the end of this story and at the end of this book and sums up a vision of the book is that ultimately, and the prospects of this narrator are that in the afterlife, his ghost and Ho's ghost will be able to help each other in a place where they are no longer under the stresses of life on Earth, and that the sense of southernness, the sense of northernness, the sense of the heart and the mind, the sense of the split in the human spirit can be reconciled and brought harmoniously together.
Should we take this as a sort of emblem of your optimism for the future of what we would call the life of the South in the United States? You know, we hear stories about how Dixie is becoming Americanized or America is becoming Dixieized. Mm-hmm. You use the vehicle of the Vietnamese in the South to examine this clash.
Yeah. Optimism is an oversimple word. Because there is something lost as well. The cultural identities that are so charming and delightful and profound and richly varied.
You don't want to get away from the complexities.
We do not wish to lose those. No, the homogeneity of self is not the alternative. It's a much more complex kind of union, one that perhaps cannot be accomplished on this planet.
The nature of art,
and that's it's only in death that my narrator in the title story hopes to be able to begin that process.
Robert Olin Butler, tell me about your new book. This is a novel called They Whisper. You've tried some pretty daring stuff here, have you not?
Yes, well, I keep trying to challenge myself, Wayne. And this book was a very important book I've been waiting all my life to write. And the breakthrough for this book was my access to women's voices that I found in A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain. They Whisper, ironically enough, because They Whisper is a book about the nature of physical intimacy between men and women. And it's written from a male, strictly heterosexual point of view in the voice of a man who's trying to understand this landscape that he lives in inside himself and carries around with him all the time, wherein dwell all the women he's ever loved, from incomplete glancing away ways to much more complete and traditional ways. All these women are still very much alive in him, sensually, in his memory. And as he ponders them and tries to understand the nature of women's hold on him, and his attachment to them, as he meditates on the women of his past as an expression of and a reflection of his intimacy with them, he lapses into their first-person voices. So the book is full of the voices of women also, filtered through this man who deeply loves and listens to women.
You make me think of, is it D.H. Lawrence who says that for Americans, sex is a sort of dirty little secret, and what you're doing is writing about physical intimacy, psychological intimacy, without that snigger hovering over the page.
Yes, exactly. The sexuality in this book, and there's a kind of motif of the use and abuse of religion in this book as well. Sexuality in this book is seen as a kind of secular sacrament. That is, it's non-religious sacrament, in that sacramentalism is the physical, earthly, sensual sign of some deeper, much deeper spiritual or cosmic kind of reality. And that is how sexuality and women's bodies and men's bodies are understood in this book.
Bob Butler, although you may be the least Southern, so to speak, of all of the writers who have appeared on this sounding series on contemporary Southern fiction, reflect for me nonetheless from your standpoint as a teacher of fiction, as an individual who has written about the South, about Vietnamese culture in the South. Where are we headed in terms of our Southern literary heritage? Do you think of it in terms of just American literature and let it go at that?
Yeah, I would primarily express my deep discomfort at a role as social pundit, and go back again to that impulse in me which makes me write fiction as opposed to essays or philosophy or sociology or anthropology or anything else. That my deepest impulse is to see the world and to see experience and see life here as in its individual terms, in its sensual terms, and seeing in its individuality, in its sensuality, the universals of the human spirit. I think the region gets left out somewhere along that process.
Now, you realize, Bob Butler, that a lot of what you're saying implies a kind of, as you just said, a universality of experience. That runs directly counter to many of our current philosophical and critical notions about human experience. Mm-hmm. It is all fragmented. It is all contingent. You reject that, whether we're talking about Vietnam or the South or whatever.
Let's look at our great Southern writers. Do you not expect William Faulkner to be read 500 years from now, and people be able to enter the world of his books? I hope I'm making a contribution to what people will continue to call Southern literature and Southern culture, because I feel Southern in certain ways. Ultimately, though, it seems to me that it's a bogus question, and that we must look at each other as absolutely universally united in the human experience?
Well, it may be a bogus question, but it holds out a lot of hope for when we speak of in large terms, such as a national identity mm-hmm. and a cultural sense of ourselves. Mm-hmm. I hear a lot of optimism there.
Yes, I think maybe there is implicit in that. I would hope that our Southernness and others' Northernness and one's Vietnamese-ness and one's Americanness and one's Italian-ness and one's Jewishness and one's one's Arabness, all of these things, we can maintain the sensual variety of that and learn to take a delight in that difference and see instantly through or work out complexly through to that common human ground beneath. And that's where we ultimately pitch our sense of self, in our shared humanity, delighting in our surface differences.
Robert Olin Butler is the author of A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, a collection of stories and novellas that won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1993. Originally published by Henry Holt, A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain is now available in paperback from Penguin Books. Robert Olin Butler's most recent book is a novel entitled They Whisper. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio tape of this program. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest was writer Robert Olin Butler. This program is the concluding segment of New Southerners, a 13-part series highlighting the work of contemporary Southern writers. New Southerners is made possible by a major grant from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund. The music you heard on this show is from an album entitled The Devil's Dream and featured the Tarwater Band. Audio tapes are available for $10. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 741. That's program number 741. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Thanks for listening to New Southerners. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.